Well, hey, good morning, and welcome to church. Welcome to church if you're attending in the room. Welcome to church if you are attending in our online audience today. Welcome one, welcome all. And tis the season, right? Tis the season for, one, it to be a little bit cold, like in this room. Okay, if you are on the online audience right now, consider yourself lucky because we've been having some HVAC issues in the room, and so it's a little bit chilly today. So don't be afraid to kind of snuggle up with your neighbor, hold a hand, put your arm around, wear your coat. I wore my coat last night during the Saturday night service because it was a little bit cold, and if you're a first-time visitor, I promise you, it's not normally like this. We pay our HVAC bills, or maybe we don't. For $1,000. Can the offering pastors come back forward, please? And for $1,000 more, we'll have heat next weekend. I promise you that. No, okay, seriously, thanks for just kind of bearing with us. It's going to be a little bit chilly today. Also, tis the season for Christmas, right? In about 6 weeks, can you believe it, 6 weeks? Wow. In 6 weeks, it will be Christmas time. And at Northeast, we believe that Christmas is a season of giving. Right. So I would just challenge you to tune your ears and tune your eyes to all the opportunities we throw at you over the next 6 weeks to get Christmas right. There will be opportunities to serve others, opportunities to give financially, opportunities to leverage your time and your talents in order to make sure that we make Christmas about God's great generosity flowing to us and flowing through us. Now, one of the ways that we do that on a regular basis, pretty much every year, is through Operation Christmas Child. And this year we're doing that again. I don't even really need to tell you what Operation Christmas Child is. Its brand is so pervasive and everybody knows so much about it. It's little shoeboxes you pack and they send all around the world so that kids who don't have Christmas get an opportunity to experience Christmas and the message of Jesus. So if that's something that you want to participate in this year, I would welcome you. This is my personal invitation to you to come join us this upcoming Wednesday at our OCC packing party. It's this Wednesday night. That's the 15th, right? This Wednesday night, 6:30 p.m. It'll be here in this room right here, and we're going to pack a bunch of boxes together. We need you to bring $9 plus enough toys to put in a box, and we'll have your boxes here for you. Now, you know who this is especially targeted for? All are welcome, but this is especially targeted for those of you who have young kids. Those of you who have kids elementary age or even younger, because we think this is a great opportunity for you to start the conversation about Christmas with your kids. It's so simple. It's such a simple way to talk to them about how this is a season of giving, not just receiving. And then in a tangible way, practice that alongside of them. You get to disciple them. You get to serve with them, which bonds the family. And ultimately, you get to build a better church here. So I would encourage you, take that opportunity. If you got any questions about that, head out in the lobby to the corner. And we've got an OCC booth set up out there. Or if you got any questions online, just message us and we'll get back to you. Now, that being said, as you guys know, this is like week 4 or 5 of a 7-month season in which, as a church, we are studying Jesus, right? And last week, we launched a new sermon series within this season in which we're asking a really, really relevant and important question in our culture today. And that is this. Whose side is he on? Whose side is Jesus on? Because we live in a country of sides, right? We live in a country of competing truth claims. In fact, in my humble opinion, we live in the most divided version of America in recent history. Now, we talked about all the points of division last week. There's no need to rehash them or rehearse them, but here are some of the places that we're divided on. And okay, here's what I think. I think at one point in time, America was, in fact, a melting pot. In fact, that's what people called our country, the American melting pot. And to a great degree, there's still lots of diversity of thought and diverse people groups in our country today. But the reality is that that melting pot has come to a boil, and it's beginning to boil over. And we are living in an absolute fantasy world if we think we can continue to pull ourselves further and further and further and further apart as a nation without completely and totally ripping at the seams. Empires have fallen before. This one can too. Now, you know what just exacerbates the violent and volatile nature of the conversation in our country today? It's this recent innovation over the last 10 years that some of you may have heard of, okay? It's called social media. Have you heard of this thing? Okay, specifically, like, it's called the Facebook. Have you heard of this thing? Do you know this? Talk to your kids. Actually, kids aren't even on Facebook anymore. That's not cool. I'm there, but kids aren't even. See, like, seriously, it's called Facebook, right? And you know what social media has allowed us to do? It's just allowed us to depersonalize debate, which is the worst way to debate. Okay, it's allowed every idiot, every racist, every extremist with an internet connection to get online and cower behind the anonymity of a screen name and say whatever they want to whoever they want to. It's impersonal, right? Okay, it's removed tone from our conversations with others, and tone matters. See, you know what tone is? Tone is what you communicate through the sound of your voice or through the volume of your voice or through all your arm motions while you're preaching, right? I get it. People talk to me about that. You know, tone is what you communicate through your facial expressions, right? Tone is what you communicate through your body posture. And in a written form of communication, like social media, there's no tone, right? So tone just gets sucked out of it. Okay, so while you might type something in a sympathetic tone, they might read it in a snarky tone. And what can you do? Here's what else gets sucked out of the conversation. What gets sucked out of the conversation is the humility that comes with debating with someone privately. See, I believe that debates happen better in private rather than public, because in private, there just tends to be more humility. It tends to be more listening, more graciousness. You might even admit, well, you know what? You were right on that, and I'm wrong. But not online, because online, you are in the public arena. Online, you have an audience. Online, you have people to win over, right? Like, people are judging you. They're measuring you. They're weighing you and your arguments, and your reputation and ego is on the line, right? So very, very quickly, you know what becomes more important than the truth in a debate? The win in the debate. And you will do anything to win. My dad always said, Tyler, never cheat unless you have to. And then online, sometimes you got to, right? So like, you pick on their profile picture, you'll go after their mama, their grammar, their character, doesn't matter. Because you want Tyler to prevail, not the truth. Okay, here's what else is interesting. You know what usually wins an argument? Not the truth. Sometimes truth wins, sometimes it doesn't. Do you know what usually wins? The best arguer. The most persuasive speaker. Okay, humble moment of confession here, all right? You ready for this? Okay, if you're new here, at this church, we have imperfect pastors, all right? I'm just saying, like, if you can't get your mind around that, maybe you need to go to another church, because, I mean, like, did you see who was on stage earlier? CJ, he's imperfect, right? I mean, maybe me too. But we got imperfect pastors, all right? And check this out. Confession. There have been times before where I've been in an argument. Like, halfway through the argument, I realized I was wrong. And even though I realized I was wrong, I was more hungry in that moment for the win rather than the truth. So I used my communication abilities and my ability to persuade, and I got the win. In fact, there have been times before where I've argued over something that I figured out halfway through was wrong, and won the argument. How wrong is that? Right, okay, now, all of you are, you know, shaking your head at me, but just by a show of hands, come on, who else can be a little bit of a stubborn hard head in here? All right, yeah. See, in America, we have a word for people like us. It's called men. More specifically, all right, women, it's a grace place, okay? But more specifically, it's called husbands, but I don't even go there. Last night in the Saturday night service, some wife pulled her husband's arm up when I said, raise your hand. And I was like, amen, we're healing marriages today. So look, what's my point? Here's my point. Let's reel it in. Okay. I don't even remember what my point is. Okay. That's my point. In a country where we are experiencing heated debate, in the most divided version of America, in a version of America where fuel just continually gets thrown on the contentious fire. In a version of America where the truth doesn't even always win the argument. Whose side should we be on, y'all? Now, you see, you know what I think we need? You know what I think would help us all as a national community? I think we need an objective point of truth. See, at the very least, an objective point of truth that we could all agree on and all submit to would at least give us a sandbox to play in. It would at least give us a common goal to move toward. It would at least give us something that we could agree on and work from in our arguments. And at the end of the day, if two sides choose at the end of an argument to agree to disagree, if we have a common point of objective truth, we'll at least move closer together through the argument. This is what we need. You see, an objective point of truth turns matters of opinion into matters of fact. And that's what we want, right? We all want the facts. But I am not so foolish as to think that we will ever agree in the United States of America on a common point of truth. We may be too far gone for that. But in the church, don't we already have one? In fact, haven't you already committed yourself to an objective point of truth at your baptism? Or when you decided to become a part of the Jesus community? You see, okay, there is an objective truth in the church, and that truth has a name, and his name is... Yeah, okay, good job. 99% of the time, if you just say Jesus, you're good. Every once in a while, we talk about the devil, and you'll be like, Jesus, and I'll be like, ooh. But most of the time, you're good. It's Jesus, right? Now, here's what makes Jesus so difficult, though, as the truth. Jesus is not a principle. Jesus isn't really a power, if you will. Jesus was a person, which means truth is always personal. But when you interpret truth through the lens of a person, it can be kind of difficult. Right? Like when you read the story of Jesus, you hear truth in his words, but you also see truth through his actions. You absorb truth through the relationships that he builds. You know, it can kind of just be gray and messy because there are some times where Jesus does this, and then there's some times where Jesus does the exact opposite of this because he runs into different people, right? It's very personal. It makes the whole thing hard. So last week we said, as a general rule of thumb, maybe we can at the very least settle on this. If you want to follow Jesus and you want to really commit to truth like Jesus did, you got to understand that Jesus speaks truth and seeks unity with everybody at the same time. See, this was his path. Oftentimes he speaks the truth with his words, but at the same time he seeks unity and community with people from all walks of life with his actions and with his relationships. It's an uncomfortable place to live because there's a lot of tension therein. And it's not always black and white. It's a little bit messy, but it's personal, right? We said last week that Jesus has soft edges but a hard core. It's easy to get to him, but if you stick around him long enough, you'll run into the cold, hard truth, right? We said last week that everyone is welcome in the circle of Jesus. Just look at who he surrounds himself with, but at the same time, everyone is challenged because he's a prophet and a pastor. He speaks with this prophetic voice of truth where he'll call everyone to accountability. But then he pastors you, welcomes you into his flock like you were the one lost from the 99. Okay, or maybe we could just boil it down to this today. And this is probably not helpful. It's not going to make the conversation any clearer. But this is what I see when I read Jesus. I study his life in the Bible. It seems to me that he was on everybody's side and nobody's side at the same time. Now, doesn't that make a lot of sense, right? Okay, over the next 2 weeks, we're going to talk about that. Now, today, I want to give you a preview of next week because some of you need to hear next week today. Like, you showed up today to hear this. And come back next week, but hear me now. Okay, Jesus is on everybody's side. Everybody's. Which means Jesus is on your side. That's good news. No matter who you are, no matter where you're from, no matter what you've done, no matter the color of your skin, no matter your gender, no matter your language of origin or country of origin, no matter the regrets in your past, what you did in your 20s, what you did last year, what you did last month, what you did last night, no matter what, right? No matter how much of a social outcast you are in religious circles, no matter how much of a social outcast you are in America, no matter how unforgivable or unlovable you believe you are, God so loved the world that 2,000 years ago, he lived the life you were supposed to live. He died the death you were supposed to die. And then he didn't stay dead. But rather, 3 days later, a heart that had stopped beating began to beat again. And blood started to flow. Arms and legs stretched out. And Jesus got up and he walked out of his tomb. But your sin and my sin did not walk out with him. You know what that means? That means that you have never lived a day of your life or breathed a breath in your life unloved by God. Because God didn't even consider the universe too far of an expanse to travel for you. No, he stooped down from the heavens above and became a man. And then he stooped down even lower and became our sin on the cross so that we might become the righteousness of God. And that's good news for you because it's for you. Jesus is for you. He's on your side today. He's on everybody's side. And the invitation is always there for you to get on his side. All you got to do is say you want it. But, and there's always a big but in church, right? You know, sometimes he's standing on stage. But, while he's on everybody's side, when I read his story and his teachings, it just seems to me like he's on nobody's side too. He calls us all out. He calls us all to grow. He calls us all to something higher and more human with our lives. In Matthew 5:48, he says this interesting thing. He says, here's my command for my disciples. Be perfect like my heavenly Father is perfect. On your mark, get set, go. And everybody left that sermon with some practical application, right? A little work to do. Because he calls us to something more. Okay, he's not content with you. He loves you too much to leave you that way. He wants to see you grow. He wants to see you better. He doesn't want to see the same person looking in the mirror at yourself 30 years from now. No, he wants to see a different, better, godlier version of you because he knows that will be a happier, more joyful, more impactful, difference maker version of you. Don't you see? Right? He's not content with you right now. And he is relentless with his conviction and his offense to drive you forward. So it's just so funny to me, right? Because Democrats try to pull Jesus to their side, Republicans to their side, left to their side, right to their side. These Christians this way, those Christians that way. And Jesus is like, look, I'm not this way or that way. I'm not on their side or their side. I'm on my side and you should be on my side because I'm the truth. So get on the side of the truth. Because the more you try to pull the truth to your side, the more you make truth a servant of you rather than vice versa. So get on my side. All right, now, I get it. That Jesus is a tough Jesus to swallow. A lot of us don't like the occasionally offensive step on my toes a little bit too hard Jesus, right? Hey, you can find churches where they won't talk about Jesus like that, or at least that version of Jesus. But here we are, because I think it's the full picture of Jesus. But sadly, some people hear that version of Jesus, and they just are like, well, you know, I don't like that version, so I'm going to ignore that version. Some people ignore parts of Jesus. I call it buffet line believers, right? they go to the buffet line and they take what they like and they leave what they don't like. Right? I'll take a little pray and ye shall be blessed, some forgiveness and grace, but all the righteousness and purity, we'll leave that on the line, right? Now, I was just going to tell you, because I love you, I'm just going to speak the last 10% here. Okay, and these are Jesus' words, not mine, so get mad at Jesus. But Revelation 3, he has an interesting title for Christians like that. He calls them lukewarm, like not hot, not cold, just lukewarm. And you know what he says God does with lukewarm Christians? Yeah. He spits them out. Now, one of my friends asked me once, what does that mean for God to spit me out? I don't really know exactly what that means. I just know I don't want it to happen to me. Now, while some people ignore parts of Jesus, other people, when they run into offensive Jesus, they just downright reject him, right? They're like, Jesus is too offensive for me, at least on that point. He offends my feelings or my cultural sensibilities, and so I can't follow that Jesus. Now, if that's you, I would encourage you today, you are in good company, right? Because there are many times when I run into things about Jesus that offend me deeply. There have been times where I've had crisis of faith, where I have to stop and have to think, study, pray, and figure stuff out. And through that, I found a list of three questions another pastor once used that I thought were so insightful to help guide me through moments like these. And I just want to suggest those to you today. Maybe these will help you. Okay, next time Jesus offends you, before you just discard Jesus altogether, I would ask you to consider the following. First, ask yourself, am I sure I'm understanding Jesus on this issue? Because sometimes the issue is you just don't understand Jesus on this issue. It's okay. The Bible's an artifact, right? It's relevant and cutting to all cultures, but it's also a 2,000-year-old artifact of a specific culture. And so sometimes you read Jesus and you don't understand him, and it takes a little bit more time and study and maybe even a wise voice to help you figure out exactly what Jesus is saying there. So first, just consider, maybe I'm not understanding this completely. Second, I would encourage you to ask, is this matter that's tripping me up an essential matter of truth? Because what I found is that a lot of people get tripped up on the last 2%, right? And I'm over here like, look, if you can get behind who Jesus was, then you can follow him. Sometimes it takes 15, 20 years to figure out some questions. Take my word on that. Sometimes some questions become and some doubts become a lot clearer from the inside. rather than from the outside. So if you can get around the core of Christianity, which is Jesus, I would encourage you, pick up your doubts, pick up your questions, and just follow him. Even before you know exactly what you believe, come and belong. And what you'll find is clarity in what you believe over time. Here's the third question, though, I would challenge you to consider. And this really gets at the heart of what I'm saying here. All right. If Jesus offends you, so much so that you're considering pushing Jesus, kicking him to the curb, would you just think with me, just reason with me for a second. Shouldn't you expect that, though? Should it not be surprising that Jesus offends you? Like, shouldn't God offend and challenge me on some level? Okay, if Jesus is in fact God, and his ways represent God's kingdom culture, then shouldn't we expect God's kingdom culture, which is divine and perfect, to offend and challenge all of our artificial, human-made, broken cultures in some way? Like, not just American culture, not just the subculture you live in, but every culture and every human being to live therein. Shouldn't we all expect the perfect God to challenge the imperfect people of this world in at least some way? I mean, he challenges different cultures in different ways, but don't you think that makes sense? That's what a God would do. And let's just keep it real. If you'll only worship or submit to a God that agrees with you on all levels, then who's the real God in that relationship anyways? Right? So, okay. In Christian circles, we use this word to talk about Jesus. And it's a little less abrasive, but it gets at the heart of it. We call Jesus countercultural, because he counters all of our cultures, all of our subcultures, and every human being therein. He always has a direction he wants to take us, and that's the direction of growth. Of holiness. It's called sanctification. And he wants to take us there today. Now, I guess the real question then for us should be, where does Jesus counter in our culture? Us. So for the rest of our time today, I just want to give you four places where I believe he does that. Four places. We're going to just bullet point through them, fly through them real quick. And the reason why I picked these four is not because they're the only four, but I believe they're the most pervasive and prominent four. And I want us to do something about it. So, okay, you can review, read it yourself real quick. I'm going to take a sip of my water, and we'll get down to business. 1, 2, 3, and 4. All right, put on your seatbelts. Let's get going. First, subjectivism. Subjectivism is very, very popular in our culture. It's called a lot of different words, but basically it boils down to the idea that tolerance is what is right and good and true. It's the best way of life, to just tolerate, right? People say it like this. They should never be critical of the opinions or life choices of others. Just tolerate everything. That's what's right. Now, while that sounds good, and that sounds right, and that sounds true, let me ask you, is it really true? Sometimes we just buy hook, line, and sinker what our culture tells us is true, but is it really true? And Christians, does this way of life line up with the way of life of our truth, Jesus? You see, okay, what I find when I read the story of Jesus is that he was sometimes, occasionally, a little intolerant or critical. One time he called the religious leaders of his day whitewashed tombs full of dead bones. One time he called them snakes. One time he called his best friend Satan himself. And Jesus knew Satan, so that was an extra bad, like, undercut, right? Get behind me, Satan. One time in John 14, Jesus said, I am the definite article here, not a, but the truth. And Jesus, that's pretty close-minded, huh? Well, it's because in some ways he was. All right. Now, I understand why people lean towards tolerance, right? It's because they believe, well, tolerance makes them two things. It makes them kind. It makes them open-minded. And if that's what you want, if you want to be a kind and open-minded person, I would encourage you in that. Those are virtues. We should be as kind and as open-minded as we possibly can be. Okay, but again, here's the real question. Is tolerance really always the pathway to these virtues? Like, is tolerance always kind? Okay, if you're a parent, you know the answer to that immediately. The answer is no. Sometimes I need to rebuke. Sometimes I need to discipline. Sometimes I need to not tolerate my kids' actions. Because that's what's best for them. That's what's kind and loving. Sometimes as a good friend, you know I can't let my friend perpetuate these bad habits because it's going to destroy their life. I need to be intolerant. Okay, kindness isn't tolerance. Your kindness is intervention. You see? Okay, how about open-minded? Is tolerance always the pathway to open-mindedness? Is it? Again, I would tell you the answer to that is no. Now, to illustrate this for you, let me tell you a story. And this is a story I believe I've told in a class here before. Some of you may have heard this, but it gets at the point really, really well. Let's pretend that one weekend, four of us decide to go camping, all right? Take a nice vacation, weekend vacation camping, which, by the way, if you know me, that would not be a nice weekend vacation for me, all right? Hiking, cool, camping, stupid, right? Okay, like, all right, I got a good idea. Let's spend the weekend sleeping on the ground, you know, without indoor plumbing. Like homeless people, that's a vacation. No, anyways, so we go camping, right? Which I wouldn't, but we do. And then we wake up the next morning on the ground in our tent to the sound of crackling wood and the smell of smoke. And we realize there's a forest fire in the woods around us bearing down upon us. Now, here's the only problem. We got to get out. But there's three paths that lead to our campsite, and none of us can remember which path leads out. So, like, friend A thinks it's one. You think it's two. I think it's three, right? But then friend four comes in, and he says, guys, you are being intolerant. Don't you know all paths lead us to safety? It could be path one, two, or three. Don't be so mean. Be kind. Now, what makes friend four right and the rest of us wrong at this moment? Actually, nothing at this point. Because we haven't stopped to actually consider which path might be the right path. Now, let me pull out of the story for a second and make a point with you about open-mindedness, because it's important. Understand. What makes you open-minded isn't necessarily coming to an open-minded or tolerant conclusion, right? That's not open-mindedness. What makes you open-minded is going through an open-minded process of reasoning to come to a true conclusion, the right conclusion. Open-mindedness isn't the answer you land on. It's the process of learning, humble learning, that you're willing to go through in order to get to the right answer. You with me? So back to the story. All right, let's say we go through the open-minded process and we investigate and we see, well, path one leads to a rock face and we didn't come down a rock face. And path three has a waterfall in it and we didn't see a waterfall on our way in. But path two, do you see path two? There's a berry bush right down path two. And we saw the berry bush on the way in. You ate some of those berries. Didn't turn out good for you. But there's a berry bush right there. So it's path two. It's obviously path two. Path two, right. Hands in. Path two on three. One, two, three. Path two, right. Now, if in that moment, though, friend four steps back in and says, guys, you're being intolerant. You're being closed-minded. Don't you see? It's all paths. All paths lead us to safety. All paths lead us to salvation. In that moment, I want you to consider, who's being the closed-minded one now? Don't you see? You see? Subjectivism, tolerance makes promises. But it can't keep its promises. It's not always kind. Tolerance is not always the open-minded conclusion. Now, what I love about Jesus, though, is that he gives us the true path to kindness. He says, here's how to be perceived as kind to the best of your ability. Be 100% committed to truth and 100% committed to unity at the same time. And Jesus invites us all to reason, to be open-minded. He says, count the cost. Weigh the options. Come and see. Belong before you believe. And that's what I love about Jesus. Now, here's the second thing that Jesus goes after. He goes after our nationalism, the idea that it's all about America. And if you want the full meal on this, get online and watch the message from 2 weeks ago where we talked about Jesus and politics. But I just want to review that this week really quickly. You know why the conversation around politics is so heated in our country and culture today? Why it's so volatile and violent and angry and full of apocalyptic doom? It's because people are looking to America and their politics for salvation and hope. And Jesus is over here like, guys, that's my job. All right, so here's how you know if you may have your priorities out of whack and the kingdom of America is more important to you than the kingdom of God. One, if your political filter informs your faith filter ever, then your kingdoms are out of whack. And this is what we like to do. We look to our party or our politician first when an issue comes up, and then we use Jesus to support that. That's wrong. Should be the opposite. If you hate your political enemies, Jesus at least isn't completely your king, because King Jesus doesn't give us permission to hate anybody. If your political leader can do no wrong, like you're willing to defend everything they do, everything they say, even if it's morally reprehensible, then you've deified your political leader rather than Jesus. And let me remind you, running for president doesn't make you a god. Winning a presidential election doesn't make you a god. Rising from the dead after you call it makes you a god. if your American rights ever take precedence over your Christian responsibilities, ever. If your kingdom looks more American than global, you got the wrong kingdom. The church was around 1,700 years before America. There will be more non-white, non-English-speaking people in heaven than there will otherwise, at least if Jesus came back today. If you believe your version of America would save the world, or if you believe the end of America would be the end of the world, you've got the wrong king, right? Because Jesus is like, whoa, 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 okay, I'm the end of the world. It's my job. There's this interesting interchange in John 19 where Jesus talks with one of the kings of his day, the governor of his land named Pilate. It's right before his crucifixion, and he's not being very cooperative with Pilate, and so Pilate's getting frustrated. This is what Pilate says. He's like, why don't you talk to me? Don't you realize I got power over you? I got the power to free you or crucify you. I got power over you. And Jesus, he looks back at him, and this is what he said. He said, you'd have no power over me at all unless it were given to you from above. Or in other words, he says, I got the power. I gave you the power. I'm the King of Kings. And one day, every governor, every king, every prime minister, every dictator's knee will bow and their tongue will confess that I'm the Lord of Lords. Period. So look, okay, hear me now, hear me. On a weekend where our country is very patriotic and rightfully so, you need to hear me say this. I'm proud to be an American. I'm not so selfish as to not be grateful for what many of you men and women in this room have secured for me and me, the people in our country. Freedom. Thank you. I couldn't preach this sermon in many other countries. Thank you. I'm proud to be an American. All I'm saying to you today is to make sure that your patriotism is in its proper place, and that's not first place. Jesus gets that, right? All right, third, individualism. This is the most pervasive. It says it's all about me. It's the truth claim. It's the idea that life is all about you. It's the idea that the key to happiness is to achieve your dreams, get paid for your passion, look within yourself to find yourself. Now, while that may sound good and nice and true, the question is it really? Because in my opinion, nothing has caused more depression and more gloom and more sadness and self-loathing and insecurity and workaholism in our country than this idea right here. Because you see, basically there are two kinds of people in life. There are people who achieve their dreams and people who don't, right? And those who don't achieve their dreams work their whole life and they get tired. But they work their whole life and they destroy their physical health. But they work their whole life and their relationships fall apart. But they work their whole life and they're never content, right? They can never be grateful because they haven't quite reached that dream yet. So they work their whole life only to get to the end of their life and not achieve their dream and feel insignificant. That's what some people in this room today, I just described you. It's because that's your truth. Now, there are some people on the other end, though, that get lucky enough to achieve their dreams. And in my conversations with folks like this, you know what they tell me? Feels good at first, but eventually you realize that that dream wasn't quite as dreamy as it promised to be. It can't give me the apocalyptic soul-level satisfaction that I wanted it to. And this is why so many celebrities can be so sad or suicidal. This is why many rich people spend the end of their career pushing their money and power away into humanitarian causes. Because they realize life has got to be about more than just me, right? Now, okay, this is what I love about Jesus. This is what he challenges with. He says, no, life's not about you. Christianity says life's about me. It's about Jesus, right? It's all about me. So he says, to find yourself, don't follow your heart, surrender it. Then you'll find yourself. He says, look, okay, sure, pursue your passion. Just make sure your passion isn't your passion. Make sure your passion is my passion, which is people. And then you'll always have purpose standing right in front of you, no matter how high or low you are on the org chart. You'll always have something with eternal significance to love. He says the key to happiness isn't actually seeking happiness. It's so counterintuitive. He says if you seek happiness, you'll never find it, but rather seek holiness. Love God and love others, because that's the highest good. And then, if you run after the highest good, happiness will get thrown along with it. Don't you see? He's so wise. He says it like this in Mark 8, verse 34. Some of you need to meditate on this week. Memorize this verse. He says, if any one of you wants to be my follower, you must give up your own way. Take up your cross and follow me. If you try to hang on to your life, guess what? You'll lose it. But if you give up your life, for my sake, for the sake of the good news, which is that God loves everyone, you'll save it. What do you benefit if you gain the whole world but lose your own soul? Is anything worth more than your soul? So good, right? So good. So wise. All right, my last one. We're done. Last one. Jesus comes after our materialism, which is perhaps the most dangerous one for our culture. The idea that it's all about stuff, Jesus comes after that. Let me explain this to you theologically, okay? One, all humans have appetites. All of us. We're just a big bundle of appetites. Two, that's not a bad thing. That's actually a good thing. A God thing, if you will. Your appetite for work, for sex, for significance, for belonging, for food, for security, for joy, all hardwired inside of you by God. However, your appetites act like appetites, which means they're always hungry. Feed me, feed me, feed me, feed me, but they're never full. You may fill them up for the night, but you'll wake up the next morning hungry again, and they just say, feed me more, feed me more, feed me more, which puts you in a bind. Because you can either choose to control your appetites, or eventually your appetites will come to control you. And that's called an addiction, and an addiction will destroy you. Now, Jesus says that there's one appetite that's more dangerous than the rest, though, and that appetite is money. It's stuff. It's affluence. One time in Matthew chapter 6, he says, you cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve both God and money. Another time he says, where your treasure is, there your heart will also be, because your stuff and your heart are inextricably bound. Now, if you don't believe me, let me prove it to you. Let's pretend I had a blank check up here and I could write it to you today. For whatever amount you believed would set your family up for comfort for the rest of your life. All right, I want you to think of that number in your head. Okay, now you ready? I'm gonna tell you what that number is, because I'm that good. All right, that number is more than what you currently have. Because I don't know what you have, but I know what you need, okay? And we all believe we need more, right? We need better. We need the upgrade. Some of y'all went out and got the iPhone 10 this week, all right? And I ain't judging. I ain't judging. I'm just saying you went to the store and you handed over your iPhone with a big wad of cash for an iPhone. But I ain't judging, because some of y'all get up in the morning, you go into your closet for 30 minutes and stop around, then walk out in your PJs and yell at your husband, and your husband didn't do nothing. He's just making breakfast. But you yell at your husband, honey, I don't have anything to wear. Okay, now, you see? We've convinced ourselves that we need more, but really we have more than enough. Now, that is why Love the Ville is so important to our church, because it counteracts our desire and appetite to get more with a commitment to give more. And I would be greatly remiss not to remind you that coming up here in 6 weeks is Christmas Eve here at our church. And for the last several years on Christmas Eve, in one day, we collect a huge offering to fund Love the Ville for the next year. Okay, I want to catch you before Black Friday, y'all, all right? I'm just saying, right? I want to catch you beforehand and let God start to work on you now before, you know, the commercials online start, Amazon starts working on you, all right? Here's the deal. Every year, we just say, hey, the lid to Love the Ville will be whatever you give, so give. Last year, you blew us away, $300,000, a little bit over it in a day. Yeah, it's crazy. Okay, and if you want to know the kind of stuff that gets poured into, just listen during offering. We tell you a story every single week. I'll give you a bigger picture of that in the coming weeks for those of you who are intrigued. But I just want you to hear me say, we need you. God needs, and I know it's crazy to say God needs, because he owns the cattle on a thousand hills, but he's decided to work through us. So God needs your generosity, wants it, desires it. And so I got around the table with some of our outreach staff who decide what we do locally and internationally. And recently, we came up with our plan for 2018, and we got a new number that we think we need this year. And I just wanted to share it with you real quick. I know we're about out of time, you may want to sit down for this, because we got a few new ideas and a lot of good old ones. And so, we're thinking that next year we're going to need somewhere around $500,000. That's like $500,000 to get done what we believe God wants to get done in this city. And I just want to throw that out there. And you know what? Maybe I have too little faith, but I don't necessarily think that we'll pull that off. I mean, that's a lot of money, $300,000 to $500,000. I'm not sure we will. But you never know what God might do with somebody's bonus check, or what God might do with somebody's savings account, or what God might do with somebody's Christmas. He might turn it upside down, right? And I just want you to know that the lid on Love the Ville will never be ideas. We'll always have ideas. It will never be need, because there's always need everywhere. It will always be resources. So you know what $100 can do? $100 can feed 100 homeless men, which is what we do with it every single weekend. Know what $1,000 can do? It can fund a daddy-daughter dance at one of our local public schools, where we create a safe space for dads to connect with daughters in a world where dads seem to be absent. Know what $2,500 can do? It can fund a refugee family that gets displaced to our city and get them on their feet and self-sufficient in 3 months. Know what $10,000 can do? It can fund the Love the Ville Christmas party that we do in this room every single year for about 250 of our partner schools' most at-risk kids. Kids who won't have Christmas. We invite them in. We'll give them a meal. We'll give them about 8 or 9 presents. Most of them are life's basic essentials. And then we send them home with a ham so they'll have something to eat the next 2 weeks out of school. Oh, yeah, and we tell them about our great God of generosity. And we show them what he looks like. So, look, life's more than stuff, right? It's more than stuff, and we all got enough of it. We got enough stuff. So I would encourage you, make this a season of giving. All right, I'm over time. So let me close by saying this. This is what Jesus wants of us. One word. I can sum up the Christian life in a word. He wants different. He wants different. And the less different we are, the less relevant we are. So let's commit to being different. Let's commit to God's higher calling. He calls us to something higher, so let's be ready and willing to answer the call. Will you stand with me right now? Let's repeat our Jesus Creed together, because this is the truth that unites us. Will you say this with me? Jesus is God, our King. He was, he created, and he promised. Then he became, he lived, and he died, for God is love. He rose, he sent, and he ascended. Now he revives, he heals, and he perfects, for Jesus lives in us. God is Jesus, our King. God, this week, perfect us, grow us by the power of Jesus. In his name, amen. Hey, if you're a first-time guest, check us out at the Guest Relations Kiosk. Oh, CJ, I'm stealing your job. Check us out at the Guest Relations Kiosk. And if you need prayer or a pastor, we'll be in the fireside room for you right outside that door. Thank you, guys. Thank you, CJ.